trouble sleeping? Your mind racing? So what do? We get help. There are people in our community who are here for us. Sometimes just talking to someone can make all the difference in the world. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
The Todd Allbush Show.
Troy, our grand prize winner from that just a bit outside the movie Text to Win contest out in beautiful Mount Horeb.
You gotta go see this movie. You know, you'll laugh, you'll cry. I know that sounds cliche, but it's true.
It is.
The no narrator was perfect for this movie, and that's what made the movie.
Yeah.
Seeing the players in their own words telling these stories.
The Todd Allbush Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Tune in this week to Seth Faces the Music, where I'll be playing songs about lies, and that's the truth. Check it out every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. on WFHR.
Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today's program was, or is, going to be the last of our DNC coverage for the week. I hope you've enjoyed the week that we've spent going back and looking at the interviews we did at the DNC. This is going to be the last of it. But for the next couple of weeks here at the program, we're going to be taking some time away. And replaying our time at the DNC. This is totally unexpected. Something personal came up, and it's unavoidable. My wife had a terrible bad accident, and we're not sure if she's going to make it. So for the next couple of weeks, what we're going to be doing is replaying some rerun material, sharing with you our time at the DNC, and that. This is the heart of election season. I would love nothing more. You have no idea how much I would love nothing more than to be talking politics and being out on the road. But my wife was in a terrible motorcycle accident. Someone didn't see her and pulled out in front of her, made a left-hand turn in front of her. And from what I'm told, she didn't have a chance. Even the best rider, it was going to be unavoidable. And she is struggling right now. And for all the people who have sent their thoughts, their prayers, their wishes, their vibes, thank you. At this point, that's all that can be done. Medically, the people at the Hershey Medical Center in Hershey, Pennsylvania, have done everything they can do. And they have been incredible. The SEIU nurses, the Teamsters, support people, the folks there have just been incredible. And I want to thank them for all of their understanding, all of their professionalism, and everything that they've done thus far. Ultimately, it's now a wait and see. If she regains consciousness, maybe we got a chance. But for the next couple weeks at least, we're going to be dealing with our family issue. And the hope is that you stick around. The hope is that you enjoy the programming going forward. I know it's going to be reruns. But I want to express my gratitude for everybody. Thank you. And if you have got thoughts, prayers, vibes, good feelings, any of that, she could really use it. Thanks. When we come back, Carolyn Gleach, a U.S. Senate candidate from Utah, is going to be here.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
One of the things I love about coming to these conventions, it's about the policy, yes, but it's also about the people running for public office. And I've been saying for years, we need people who look like us, people who have struggled, people who have had hard times, people who have had to tighten the belt and seen the paychecks not stretch far enough. People like Tim Walz, which is why I'm so high on Kamala Harris's vice presidential pick. But we also need people who are going to be in the House and in the Senate, and here to share some thoughts on her senatorial race out in Utah. Maybe we send Mitt Romney on into vacation and we replace him with a Democrat. That's why I've asked Carolyn Gleick to come talk with us. Carolyn, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
No, this is a big deal. I'm thrilled to see someone who really has had some struggles in the past, who has done some things like you've done, to throw your name out there, throw your hat in the ring, and give it a go.
Yeah, I'm super grateful for the opportunity. I am running to become the first woman from Utah to go to the United States Senate and the youngest woman in the U.S. Senate. Because at 38, I'm the average age of America. The average age of Utah is 30. Meanwhile, the average age of the United States Senate is 65 years old. And we are all about respecting the leadership and wisdom of the older generation. We need the older generation to remember and teach us the lessons of history. But we also need people that understand the struggles that young people, millennials, Gen Z, the things we're going through with housing affordability, reproductive care, healthcare access, all of these, and the existential threat of the climate crisis. We have a different stake in the future than someone who's 65, and we deserve to have a voice and representation in the United States Senate.
No, look, at the end of the day, your generation's getting dumped on pretty badly. The fact that, you know, wages haven't kept up over the years, we had a labor movement that's been under attack. We've got a climate crisis down the road, and we've got all this uncertainty with AI and robotics. We need somebody who understands what it's like to struggle. And I've looked through your background, and you've had some pretty substantial struggles.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a teenager, I had a lot of mental health challenges, and I went to rehab when I was 13 years old I was using drugs and alcohol to deal with a lot of anxiety and depression, and that is so common for people of all ages, really, but our generation is one of the first that talks openly and honestly about it. And, you know, a big way that I've found to counter those feelings of hopelessness and despair is to take action and to get involved and to get organizing politically. And so I really see this, along with therapy and other modalities, as a way to fight for the change that I want to see.
Yeah, to be that person you wanted there for you back then.
Yes, and it's up to us to be the leaders that we want to see. No one is coming to save us. If we don't like the policies that are coming out of Congress, it's up to us to run for office and to get in there ourselves, because it's our generation that is going to have to deal with the issues they are failing to address today.
So what's the platform? What are we running on?
Yes, the three pillars of our platform are families, freedom, and future. First and foremost, making our economy work for families so that no one worries about losing their home if they have a healthcare crisis. We got to address housing affordability, subsidized childcare, paid parental leave. And when it comes to freedom, we will fiercely defend our reproductive freedom, get the government to stop creeping around our doctors' offices and private lives, and get back to work addressing these other issues. We also need to do things like end Citizens United and change the role of money in politics. And, you know, no billionaire should be able to buy an election. When it comes to our future, addressing the climate crisis by accelerating our transition to clean, renewable energy while supporting our legacy energy-producing communities with good-paying union jobs.
No, it sounds like a great platform, but what's the hill you die on? What's that issue that Carolyn, there's no give here. Everyone talks about, well, we're going to compromise, we're going to find solutions. What's that issue that you're just so passionate about that there's no backing up.
The last decade and a half of my life have been very focused on air quality and addressing the climate crisis, because in my home state of Utah, the average person dies 2 years early because of the air quality. We have very bad air quality.
Utah,
yes, we have.
Utah is such a beautiful place.
It is, but we live in this, you know, a lot. The vast majority of Utah lives in the Salt Lake Valley, and it's this teacup valley where the bad air just gets trapped, and we have such outdated energy policy, and it causes a 16% increased rate of miscarriage. It causes all these public health problems, asthma, cardiac events, mental health challenges, and we have to address the air quality, and in doing so, we take action on the climate crisis.
Now, I'm reading about your campaign and the person you're running against, and, you know, people are saying it's a long shot. Is that accurate?
It is a long shot, but I've taken on impossible challenges before and I've been successful. You know, as an adult, I built my career as a professional skier and outdoor athlete. And when I told people about the dreams I had of climbing the highest mountains in Utah and on the world, they said I was crazy and I'd never succeed. So I'm used to taking on impossible challenges and proving people wrong.
Well, maybe being a little bit crazy is what we need.
You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And I've been, you know, as a petite woman, I've been underestimated my whole life, but I am a fierce and happy warrior, and I am not giving up this U.S. Senate seat without a fight, because the people of Utah deserve to have a voice.
Oh, no, look, you know, your generation needs a voice as well, and sadly what's happened over the last 40, 50 years is we're moving in a direction that's harmful for working people, as we've destroyed labor unions, as we've destroyed our environment, as we're undoing regulations. There's a lot of work to be done, a lot of cleanup. The right has their plan. If you've seen Project 2025, it's a horrible document that's going to repeal the 20th century. What we need is that vision for the future, your future.
Yes, we need progress 2025, because we have one party that's going to take us backward, and the next, our party, is going to take us forward, and we're going to provide a real meaningful difference for rural Americans, for working class Americans, and for everyday families that are struggling to afford childcare, to afford health care, and to keep the roof over their head.
I got to imagine out on the campaign trail, when you're out there kissing babies and shaking hands, that you're just well received.
I don't look like a U.S. senator, and that is exactly what Utah wants and needs right now. And so I'm really grateful for this opportunity to help push for progress in my state.
And it'd be a huge change, because you're not a multimillionaire.
I'm not a multimillionaire. I'm not a career politician. This is my first time running for office.
Wow, shooting for the big time.
I like to go big. I like to dream big. And Utah's never seen a candidate like me. America's never seen a candidate like me. And I'm also really excited about the opportunity to inspire a new generation of leaders to step up, because there's no reason why we can't do it.
No, absolutely. So what can we do to help? What can folks do to help? I know resources you need, volunteers you need. For our audience in Utah, how can they help you become the next senator from the great state of Utah?
Well, anyone around the entire country, anyone who's an American citizen, can go to my website, caroline4utah.com, and chip in a couple bucks, because as a first-time candidate, it costs, you know, the average cost of a winning Senate seat in 2022, what do you think it was?
$5 million?
$15.7 million. Dollars.
I'm so outdated.
It is brutal. I want to change the influence of money and of big money in politics, but until I get into the U.S. Senate, I have to play the game. So if you can chip in $1, $5, $20, or the campaign maximum, $3,300, if you could do that, it will really help us to reach voters across the state and to show what's possible for a young first-time candidate. And then if you are in Utah or even nationally, you can sign up to volunteer on our website. Under the Get Involved tab, you can sign up to write postcards. We'll mail them to you. And wherever you are in the country, you can help our campaign by sending those postcards to reach voters across the state.
I got to tell you, like in this room, the energy of this convention, I love the energy that you're bringing to this.
Together, we're going to send the first woman to the White House and the first woman from Utah to the U.S. Senate. And I love being this part. I love being a part of this party that defies stereotypes and has no limits on what we're capable of.
No, look, I want to leave a better place for my children and grandchildren. And this looks like the path. So, again, I wish you nothing but the best. If there's anything we can do to help, by all means, reach out. Give that website again.
Caroline4utah.com.
Outstanding stuff, Caroline. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great chatting with you.
What we need are more people who are going to run for office and, well, do the good work. Caroline, thanks so much. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. One of the things that I've talked about numerous times in this program, the idea of economic freedom and the idea that working families need that safety net under their feet. I was fortunate enough when my children were born to be able to take family medical leave. Problem was, no economic help. So the 7 weeks I took off, unpaid. How do we get to a place where we don't have to do that, where we catch up to the rest of the industrialized world? And that's why I've asked Dawn Hucklebridge to come talk with us. She's the founding director of the Paid Leave PAC. They are the folks who are fighting to ensure that we get paid leave. Dawn, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is one of those niche-y kind of things that people don't talk about very often, but I think a radically important idea, something that Tim Walz, as governor, did a little something on.
He definitely did. And he has said that if we have a governing Democratic trifecta, he thinks the first thing that we should do is pass federal paid family medical leave.
That fits right into what I've been saying. We've got to make lives better.
Yeah.
This administration, when they win in November, has got to be about making lives better. Me as a union guy, I say union job, better life.
Yeah.
We need much stronger unions and policies that are going to help move that, but also federal policies and state policies that are like paid leave that are going to help move us there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so as the genius, how do we get there?
We just pass it. We were so close.
We just passed
it. In 2021, we were then essentially one vote of getting this done in Congress. And the truth is, it is important for new parents. But you mentioned it's not as talked about as often. I think it's really important to say this should be considered a really mainstream, economic, everyday kitchen table issue.
Nonpartisan.
Yeah, and the support across party lines is through the roof. It's one of the most popular issues in the country, with however you break down the demographics, the parties. And it's not just new parents. It's anyone who needs to take care of themselves or a family member when there's a serious health condition. And, you know, breaking news, it's going to be every single one of us at some point. And there's going to be more and more as baby boomers age and people are sandwich caregivers dealing with kids and parents and other family members. This is an economic imperative.
And long overdue. Look, I remember doing work, getting family medical leave, the FMLA passed. But I remember at the time going, what really is the point of having the right to turn off, to take time off, to spend time with family or to take care of someone if you can't afford to do it?
Right.
If there's no economic part of this, what did we win?
Right. And if you can't actually make use of a policy, then it doesn't help you. Right. So we're trying to finally finish the second part of what FMLA started 31 years ago. This is so overdue. As you said, we're one of only seven countries. It's us and some small island nations who haven't done this yet.
And we are the wealthiest nation of all of them.
Oh, of course. I mean, we're talking about Papua New Guinea. And, you know, so the time has come, and it is truly, it's an economic issue, it's a public health issue, it has to do with equity, lowers depression, improves the maternal mortality rate. It is truly this magnificent issue, in my mind, I will say, that both the Vice President and Governor Walz are championing, and so I'm really hopeful we'll finally get it done.
So you started this back in 2019, this idea of pushing for this policy. Again, you know, like I said, 31 years ago, we were fighting for this,
yeah.
The paid part of it. What made you decide that this is my issue, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think every one of us at some point will have a story. And I'd worked in sort of progressive policy and organizing and gender politics for quite a while. And could do the same lip service about this issue. It sounds great, you know, it's nice. Then I became a mom in America and realized how unnecessarily, unbelievably hard it is, even for those of us who are some of the luckier in this country. You know,
yep.
I had a little bit of paid family leave. I had health insurance. I had family. And it still almost broke me. And I just kept thinking, I learned that only 1 in 4 working people in the private sector have paid family leave from their jobs. So there are people, 1 in 4 women go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. And I just kept thinking, how do they survive? And the truth is, many of them don't.
I get a cold, and it's, you know, more than 2 weeks before I
Well, yes, thank you. Yeah, I mean, this is common sense, humane stuff. And also, it's important to know there's a return on the investment. People think this is too hard for businesses, this is a burden, this is expensive. No, actually, there is a positive return on the investment. If we pass paid leave and other care policies in the United States, it would yield millions of jobs, billions in wages. I think the latest estimate was $775 billion in new economic activity for the overall economy.
Wow.
So this is a...
And happy employees.
Exactly. Happier people.
Because not all of us have a mother-in-law with a PhD who can take a year off sabbatical to come take care of our children.
We do not all. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, look, you know, my family was 300 miles away. Not that I wanted them to come take care of my children, because how badly they screwed me up. That's not true. But, you know, we didn't have that safety net, and a lot of families, unfortunately, don't.
Right. And that's a famous line. I'm sure people know that other countries have safety nets, and United States has said women. But women and caregivers can only do so much. It's going to be a house of cards. And if we want to build an actually secure and resilient economy, this is something we just have to do.
Yeah, and look, our economic policies haven't created an environment for families either. My wife and I were very fortunate that we could survive and do well on one income.
Yeah.
So my wife was able to stay home and raise the kids. Most, unfortunately, don't have that opportunity.
Right.
And by not having that opportunity, you're putting the burdens on you know, both parties on, you know, whatever safety net they have, instead of going, look, you know, maybe we talk about family policy a lot.
Yeah.
Talk about how much we like family.
We talk about family values, right?
Yeah. That's the phrase.
Yeah.
We talk about that quite frequently, but we don't seem to be pushing those kind of policies. I would love for J.D. Vance, who, you know, like I said, had the mother-in-law come spend a year with them. We're talking several weeks, right?
Right. Right.
It'd be nice to see him put his name on something like paid family
leave. I agree, and I don't think paid leave appears anywhere in the Republican platform. I've often said this, like, if you're going to pay lip service to family values, show some action, you know, take a real stance.
So how do we get there? You know, what does this look like? What does a paid component look like?
Yeah, so if we, there have been different policy models. We have a bill in Congress. We almost passed the Build Back Better Act. There are committees, there are people in Congress ready to you know, hit go on this. We, as I said, we were within one vote of passing comprehensive and inclusive paid family medical leave. We know from the states, too, what works best. We've learned a lot from those models. 13 states in the District of Columbia have passed paid leave. So,
and what's been their experience?
And it's been positive, shockingly, right?
No, I mean, you know, from the side of, because there are some people who say, well, this should be a state program, a federal program.
Yeah.
This should be a mandate on employers. So there's I'm sure there are multiple ways to get here.
Yeah. No,
what are we talking about?
That's a really important question, because a lot of people misunderstand it and think it is just an unfunded mandate on employers. That is not a policy anywhere in the United States. It's not a proposal at the federal level. It's not what's happening at the state level. What we're talking about is creating a program that there's different ways to pay for it, but it is not just making businesses do this out of pocket. You know, you can either set up a social insurance fund where employees and employers contribute, you know, a
like
few dollars. Exactly. It's, you know, very small contributions that protects you for your career. Or there's other ways of taxing, you know, general revenues that tax the wealthiest corporations of this country. And you can do, anyway, there's a number of ways to do it. But we know that it works. And when you looked at the states, look at California, who's had this for many years. Again, there is a positive return on the investment. It has shown workers are more productive. There's higher performance. There's higher profitability. It has only been a boon to business. So this is particularly a small business-friendly issue.
So if that's the case, and it's been a boom to business, why haven't they been championing it? It's like I've been saying about healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, why haven't they been saying, get this health insurance thing off our back?
Yeah.
That's not why I run this business.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons. I think we live in a country that has had political systems, to be honest, that have been pretty male-centric in the past, that have been pretty wealthy white man male-centric.
But here's the thing, and this is where you're going to lose me on this whole division thing, because I took 7 weeks off to welcome our children into this world.
Yeah.
I think most men want that opportunity. I doubt that there's a man out there who said, no, I'd prefer not to spend the first 7 weeks of my child's life holding them and doing all the things that we have to do.
I totally agree.
To be able to afford to do that, that's the barrier for most people.
No, I totally agree with you. I don't think anyone, I've never really heard anyone say they're against the idea of paid leave. No. But I do think it has been often deprioritized. It's been the first thing cut in compromises because it has been, I think, seen as disproportionately impacting women. So therefore, not quite as mainstream economic. I think we're proving that's wrong. I also think there are some big businesses who have lobbied against what they see could be a corporate tax hike, period. It depends, again, how you fund it. But
again, it comes down to the values that we have.
It does. It does.
And look, the question then becomes, you know, especially on the right, and there might be some on the left that have the same thought, but this isn't the opposition to getting it done, more about just getting women back into the kitchen. I mean, look, if it's an out-of-bounds question, go, hey, that's too far. But it seems like, you know, we have a political party in this country hell-bent on putting women back in the kitchen, gays back in the closet, and minorities back in the fields.
And I don't think that's, like, they're not hiding that. That's, like, it's pretty clear, And so I think it's funny that some people are like, we don't need paid leave because you don't have to go back. You know, you don't need child care. You had the baby, now you're at home and you're watching it. And, no, I think it's obvious, and I think the vision that is being presented is it's ludicrous to me. It's ludicrous to many people, but I hope the rest of America, I think we're seeing everyone catch on to this and get it. I think the vibes are changing. I think the vision is changing. I think Kamala Harris was right on time.
The vibes. All right. It's the vibes. So then wouldn't the vibes naturally take us, if we're encouraging people to have children, to actually then, you know, start to take care of them?
Right.
You know, maybe some child care stuff.
Yeah.
Some pre-K, some of that stuff, maybe little sprinklings around the side.
That'd be great. That'd be so pro-life. Yeah.
So is that the next pack?
Well, I mean, I think we fight for paid leave. We fight for child care. We fight for the CTC. We fight for, I mean, I'm so blessed where I live. I had free preschool at 3 years old for my kid. I mean, that was, I remember weeping. I was in Washington, D.C. And it saved me tens of thousands of dollars a year.
Everyone's moving to Washington, D.C. to have kids. if the vibe, especially on the right, is we want people to have more kids, since J.D. Vance seems to be attacking women without children and their motives, if we're going to encourage people to have children, they're expensive.
Yeah. Well, particularly in this country. But it's interesting. We talk a lot about, you know, the political issues historically. We talk about the price at the pump, the cost of milk. To have a child, to give birth alone in this country is often tens of thousands of dollars. Child care can cost more than college in most states. If you think about losing 12 or more weeks of wages, think about even, you know, aging and disability care is even more. I mean, these are the biggest sources of financial and emotional stress for American families. And so they need to be considered front and center economic agenda priorities, which I think the VP is doing.
So, you know, kind of to wrap this up, because I think what you're talking about is, you know, maybe finding a social safety net to ensure that families don't fall through the cracks.
Right, exactly.
None of us are as fortunate as J.D. Vance and Donald Trump to have other people raise their children.
Right, right. It's not reflective of what has the American reality. It's never been that. I mean, throughout most of history, we've needed to have multiple people working to get by in this country. And it's not where the voters are across party lines, as I said. This is the paid leave we have in battlegrounds. We did polling recently. 85%. Of battleground voters.
Yeah, you can't get 85% of those people to say the sky's blue.
Exactly. So I'm hopeful. I'm really excited. I think next year is the year we get this done.
I hope you're right. So between now and then, what do we do last bit?
I would say make sure that people know that elected officials work for you. So use your voice, use your vote. Talk about this. Talk about your story, why you need paid leave. And make sure that they are accountable and respond in kind.
And clearly visit the Paid Leave Pack
Paid
website.
Leave Pack. In my day job, I work for Paid Leave for All. You can learn more about our nonpartisan work. This is a fight. It's a growing movement. It's a fun party. Hope you'll get on board.
There you go. Dawn, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
I appreciate you.
Thanks so much. Want to hear your thoughts. Is this something we need? Is something we want? Do we want paid leave? I know I did. And I'm for it for the next generation because, hey, ultimately, my kids are going to probably need it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, a low in the mid-50s. A mix of sun and clouds, a shower or storm possible tomorrow afternoon and evening, high in the low 80s. Partly sunny, much cooler, only upper 60s Sunday. A few showers are possible right in through Monday. Currently at 62 degrees.
Matt Nair on air.
Wisconsin Public Radio, Dodge County clerks backtrack on using drop boxes after concerns from Republican sheriff in order to prevent the perception of voter fraud.
What is he citing as any sort of proof of concern about this?
Gut feeling. Oh, it's a gut feeling.
Yeah,
inherently.
Feel it in your bones.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the question is, how are we going to make the changes that we need? Who's going to help push the policies, educate the candidates, train candidates, so that we fill every elected office with at least a well-trained candidate who's going to go out there and fight the good fight. That's why I've asked Adam Green to come talk with us. He's with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, the co-founder of them. Boldprogressives.org is their website. Adam, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be back with you.
We saw each other not too long ago, Netroots, back in Pittsburgh, right?
Yep.
So what have you been doing since then? It's good to see you.
Shortly after that, we actually began a year-long journey doing weekly polling with our friends at Data for Progress, which we've delivered directly in the West Wing at the White House and to the then-Biden campaign, now-Harris campaign, and increasingly to House and Senate campaigns, helping them improve their economic messaging to resonate more with the American people. It's, you know, as you know very well, logically absurd that people trust Republicans more than Democrats on economics. And one of the biggest things we found, which will be not just second nature to you, but like 17 years in the making for your voice, is we need to speak to the issues that people talk about at their family, you know, kitchen table.
Yep.
It needs to be family budget issues, not macroeconomic stuff. So when we directly told people inflation rates are going down, the unemployment rate is at a record low, nobody cared. When we tell people Democrats want to do something about price gouging on grocery prices, gas, prescriptions, credit card fees, through the roof. So that's the message we've delivered to the White House and, you know,
and they're running with it. And about time.
About time.
No, because this is long overdue. We've been on the program talking about the fact that we've been getting gouged at the pump, at the cash register, in virtually everything we do, because corporate America saw a great opportunity after the pandemic to go, hey, we can fill our pockets.
You're exactly right. That was the origin of this. They realized, oh, we can get away with this. We can charge $30 for toilet paper. Interesting. Let's keep the prices up, right? It's not an accident that this started around COVID. The question is, what's going to be done about it? A couple things have been done. You know, the Biden administration, through the great leadership of Lina Khan at the FTC and Rohit Chopra at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has been actually implementing new laws, which they have the power to do, to crack down on things like higher credit card fees, bank fees, stuff like that. At the DOJ, cracking down on mergers, which make the space less competitive and therefore prices get jacked up. But even public shaming. You know, I was talking to someone at the White House who pointed out to me that there was a week where meat prices were going through the roof. They called out the meat prices. The next week, the price of meat went down. Same with the shipping industry, which affects every product that's on the shelf.
No, and this is where I gave Trump credit.
Yeah.
You know, Trump, during his term, would call those people out, and it would work. Shaming works.
That's the thing. If you can do it in a non-accountability environment, why wouldn't you do it if you're a corporate CEO, right?
Right.
So, you know, what Kamala Harris talked about this past week, which we were thrilled about and really reflected the advice we've been talking with them about for months now, intensely the last couple of weeks, is she said we're going to pass new laws to make more things illegal, not just relying on public shaming, not just relying on executive branch power, but new laws through Congress if we have a Democratic House and Senate to make things illegal. Can I share one funny story or anecdote from this convention? I am running into people, you know, there's a donor class here. Some are our kind of people and some are not. Some of the donors who are griping about the corporate price gouging language, which they take as a personal affront, say, you know, we shouldn't paint with too broad a brush. If we're going to talk about price gouging, and then they name like nine different types of price gouging, and they're like, this is what we should be talking about. Someone today who's in the medical industry is like, I don't know about the other stuff, but, you know, it's logically absurd that people should get extensions for patents on things like insulin. You know, when your patent runs out, it should cost $40 as a generic, not $400 or $4,000. We should talk about that, not generic price gouging. It's like, great, let's talk about that, right? So even those who are a little defensive are feeding us great points and affirming our our underlying point that there's a lot of abuse.
It's abuse everywhere. It's amazing, yeah. Though. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Because as they're deflecting from themselves, yeah, they're exposing everybody else.
Yes, exactly. Another guy today, yeah, it's a little more wonky, but it's like, you know, when it comes to grain and bread, there's like one company that at the end of the day controls 60% of the bread industry. Crack down on them. It's like, is that grocery price gouging? That's exactly what Kamala Harris just talked about, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, and we're saying the same thing. It's really, you know, there's not really a contestation of the core point that we're making.
That's a much more difficult argument, Adam,
yeah,
than saying Joe Biden did this.
Right.
It's a much different argument saying, you know, consolidation has caused a bunch of this, corporate greed, you look at the earnings reports, that's the real problem. It's easy to go, Joe Biden flipped a switch in the White House, and Joe Biden hates you.
Yeah. Well, just to piggyback on that a little bit, one of my retorts to these people, which gets a begrudging head nod, is, you know, somebody will be left holding the bag on higher prices. Do you want it to be Joe Biden and Democrats? If not, you better talk about corporate price gouging. So you figure out how you want to talk about it, but if not, you're letting our side take the blame. And we're at the Democratic convention. They're like, oh, right. So it's kind of a checkmate argument, but no, it works. It works.
You have to have a counter argument.
Yeah.
And then you have to have a vision of how you're going to solve those problems.
Yeah.
And do you think that what you're saying is being heard by this administration? Because, look, you know, I've had people say, you know, we went to the White House, we talked to Biden, we talked to Harris, they listen. We talked to, you know, the Harris and Walls, they listen.
Yeah.
Are you finding the same dynamic?
If you had talked to me 2.5 weeks ago, I was somewhat in a freak out state where we were on calls with other people that share our working class values. And it's like, who's advising her on economics? We have no idea. What's her policy? We hope it's Biden-Harris trajectory, good stuff, but we don't know for sure. Since then, in the last 2.5 weeks, three things have happened. One, Tim Walz, right? An effortless populist. Somebody who's in his bones is on the side of working people, owns
yep.
no stocks, right?
Doesn't own a house.
Doesn't own a house. So if he's the last person in the room, I'll feel really good about that, right? Number two is word has leaked that some of the Biden-Harris keepers of the flame who were there for Build Back Better, they're willing to propose at the time like $3.5 trillion worth of good stuff for helping kids, helping aging parents, helping reduce prescription prices. They're back. They're back in the mix advising Harris. That's very different from hearing, oh, Larry Summers is advising her or Jason Furman or all these corporate people.
Rahm
right?
Emanuel's back.
Right. So really, every card that's been flipped so far in terms of who's around her are good cards for us, right? And then the last thing is her first economic speech, where the centerpiece was grocery price gouging. It's like, again, we sent them a memo with 6 pieces of advice. The first one was groceries. The second was talk more about price gouging. We were thrilled that that's the trajectory of where they're going. So, you know, honestly, I don't need to see a bunch of 30-page white papers to know that so far the cards look good for our side. And the fact that Larry Summers and Jason Furman, who are 2 Wall Street Democrats, are freaking out publicly seems like another bonus fourth point.
As I've always said, if Larry Summers is unhappy, I'm thrilled.
Absolutely.
Because he's been the heart of all the bad ideas on the Democratic side for quite some time.
Yep. I'm just going to agree with you. Yeah. So it's really nice to see them freaking out. And, you know, I talked to a lot of reporters and they're like, but isn't this Democratic division? This is the first time Democrats have been divided. It wasn't a mistake to talk about price gouging?
No.
No. I recall for them one thing I heard on the campaign trail last cycle from some real economic populists running in kind of rural America. And they say smartly, some issues are not left versus right. They're top versus bottom, right?
We've been saying that for the longest time.
I'm not breaking any news to you. Again, the Rick Smith Show is on the front guard, you know, the front lines, vanguard of this movement. But America's catching up in D.C. in terms of D.C. chatter, right? But not these reporters who were like, oh, this is division. Good. Division is good if it's out with the old, in with the new, and we're appealing to an entire new set of Republican and independent voters who feel like the system's not working for them. It's okay that the corporate elite in some of these rooms here, frankly, are mad about it. That's good division. That's not Democrats in disarray. That's Democrats broadening their audience by focusing on these top versus bottom issues, the things that you've been talking about.
No, it's extremely important. It's important to have those lower-level candidates as well. So as you're doing these media yeah. trainings and your candidate trainings,
yep.
This is the message. And look, the right, you're not Magellan discovering new lands.
No.
The right has been doing this to us for years, which is how we ended up with so many bad policies. This is just, to me, righting the ship.
That's exactly right. And just to focus on the down ballot thing for 1 second, if there are any current candidates for office or aspiring candidates. Oh, maybe I'd like to do that someday. If people go to our website, boldprogressives.org, there's a candidate link. You click it, get in our system, give us your contact info. We'll invite you to our candidate trainings that we do for free, how to talk on camera, how to talk to donors, how to come up with a winning campaign plan, things that especially low-budget candidates can't afford consultants to teach them. We bring really expensive consultants into the room to train folks. And we've heard from many, many people that, you know, who have done multiple candidate trainings that they learn the most at ours. We encourage people to do many candidate trainings, like build the muscle memory. But we're doing some in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania in the near future. We just did Arizona. We just did Texas. So again, boldprogressives.org. Sign up with us. Be part of the system. You know, our collective set of people. And let's make some change together.
That's amazing stuff. Last question I've got for you. You know, this convention, obviously, is a big celebration of Harris Walz,
yep,
of democratic principles and all of that. What are you hoping comes out of this? Obviously going to be a great show. What are you hoping comes out from now to Election Day?
Couple things. So her speech on Thursday is a down payment, almost a table of contents for what comes next, both, you know, any policy rollouts now, but also post-election. So we hope that when she's on the big stage, the biggest stage she'll be on, maybe apart from the upcoming debates, that she goes even deeper on corporate price gouging, really makes the case for why it's a little guy versus big guy, not just on price gouging, but Social Security, taxation, all the way down the list. You know, the care economy, which she is a big supporter of, you know, making it more affordable to raise your family, and price gouging all fall under the same roof of affordability, right? They're not two separate issues. Hopefully in her own Kamala Harris way, she connects the dots between these things and makes clear it's us versus Republicans, it's big guys versus little guys. And hopefully every reporter and every voter who's thinking about this takes notice. This is an opportunity to feed kitchen table conversation for weeks, right? The things that you say in your union hall, at your UFW, whatever, your plant, and, you know, your Rotary Club. Like, this is the moment to make the case, right? And then going forward from this, hopefully a little bit more flesh on the bones. But again, we don't need 30-page policy papers, just specific, you know, sets of going deeper.
We need big picture and aspirational.
And the last thing is, I hope it's very clear when she proposes things that we need a House and Senate to get it done. Sometimes presidential candidates can be selfish and be like, all right, I got to win. Hopefully, you know, they take care of their business. If she says, if you give me a Democratic House and Senate, here's what increased stuff I can get for the American people, hopefully less people are ticket splitters and they vote down ballot.
There you go. Boldprogressives.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Adam Green, appreciate the time.
Appreciate what you do. Thanks, Rick.
Always great to talk with you. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Back here from the United Center. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1878. That was the day that socialist author Upton Sinclair was born in Baltimore, Maryland. A prolific writer, Sinclair wrote nearly 100 books and other publications. Upton Sinclair's father and father's relatives had been wealthy Southerners. But thanks to the Civil War and its aftermath, the family was left in financial ruins. His mother was from a wealthy Episcopalian family and was very strict. Sinclair often stayed with her wealthy parents. These family experiences growing up gave Sinclair an insight into how both the rich and poor lived. Sinclair studied at the City College of New York, and for a time at Columbia University. He went on to write several popular novels that explored the experiences of working people in the rapidly industrializing United States. The Flivver King explored the impact of Henry Ford on auto production. Oil focused on the oil industry in Southern California. But Sinclair is best remembered for his classic expose of the Chicago meatpacking industry, The Jungle. The book was fiction, but based in fact. In 1904, he spent 7 weeks working undercover in Chicago's meatpacking plants to get material for the book. The Jungle was published in 1906 and was immediately a bestseller. It was originally published in serial form in a socialist newspaper. Sinclair said that he wrote the novel intending to set forth the breaking of human hearts by a system which exploits the labor of men and women for profit. The novel led to congressional legislation and federal regulation of the meatpacking industry. It helped lead to the passage of the Meat Inspection Act and the Pure Food and Drug Act. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Great thing about coming to these conventions, you meet the young, the up-and-coming, the next generation of visionary leaders, the people are going to change. People are going to have to change the world because, well, we've kind of screwed it up. The hope now, maybe we pick up the pieces, we move forward, and that's why I've asked Manny Rutenell to come talk with us. He's a Colorado State representative here at the convention, looking at seeing how we can change the world. Manny, thanks for taking time for us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Rick.
So let's start. Why are you here?
I'm here because I'm excited about the DNC. I'm excited about Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, and I'm excited about voting for them and having the whole country vote for them and having them have a resounding success come November.
Now, you're an environmental attorney,
That's
as
right.
I understand it. So I got to imagine environment, pretty big deal.
Absolutely. And Tim Walz and Kamala Harris, it couldn't be a starker difference between J.D. Vance and Donald Trump. Kamala Harris and Tim Walz believe in climate change. They understand the health equity concerns around industrial polluters and the way our highways crisscross our environmental justice communities. And I represent an environmental justice community in Colorado. And so this is a very near and dear issue to us. And I want to make sure that at the very top of our ticket, we have folks that really believe in the issues and are dealing with it.
Now, look, as a kid growing up on a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, we lived right next to Johns Hopkins International Airport. So the planes, they would fly so low, we thought we could hit them with rocks because we tried. again, this is the early 70s. You could have gotten away with that stuff back then. Not anymore. Don't try. But I suffered from asthma horribly because of where we were, because of the industrial area that was downtown Cleveland. We've gotten away from some of that, probably not far enough for your liking. How do we have an economy where the negative externalities don't end up on the back of the poor?
Exactly. I think you brought up the perfect point, negative externalities. A lot of the reason why these industrial polluters are so profitable is because they're not bearing the costs. They're putting it on to the public. And my community is a perfect example of that. We have increased healthcare costs. We can't go outside and enjoy our communities as well as we should be able to. And unfortunately, what's happening is because of that imbalance between the negative externalities, our renewable energy isn't able to always compete with the fossil fuels. But once we account for it and hold corporate polluters accountable, then we can put everyone on a level playing field and we'll be able to see renewable energy is actually a great and financially relevant decision.
No, look, if we had a national healthcare system, this is one of the reasons that I'm a big proponent of having one giant insurance pool. There's one payer of all the healthcare bills, is because maybe we start looking at, in a bigger picture, the costs of all these externalities, the cost of pollution from corporate America, the cost of what they've done to our food supply, the cost of everything that they let roll downhill. Because sadly, we poor working people, we're at the bottom of that hill, and we end up bearing the cost of it either through a lesser standard of living, less health, or, well, less life in general.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, if we had a healthcare system that had to account for all those negative externalities, then you might have policies where it's like, well, we're either going to pay for it in our healthcare system after people have these really horrible symptoms, or we can deal with it up front and just hold these corporate polluters accountable so that we don't have to pay for it after all these horrible symptoms.
Yeah, no. But can we get there? I mean, honestly and truthfully, at the end of the day, what we're talking about is rich versus poor. We like in this country to have the horse race between being right and left, when the reality has always been it's been top down. It's been the wealthy versus everybody else. Do we ever get to a point, do you think, where you get the kind of justice that you're talking about?
Well, you know, there's that saying, power is never given, it's taken. And I think what we need to do is organize. We need to get people together, make sure that we've got the right policies in place, and then fight for those policies, organize on those policies, get people to volunteer, call their neighbors about those policies. We can do that either through the ballot box while electing leaders, or we can do that through initiatives. In Colorado, we have the ability to pass initiatives. Unfortunately, what happens is these wealthy individuals and corporations have the resources to just pay to get things on the ballot because they can just hire
volunteers. They got lobbyists.
And they have lobbyists as well that can just run circles around the legislature, helping them, putting information in their ear as to why it's important to get this ballot initiative on there or this bill through the legislature. So it's really tough, and it's hard to right that wrong when all these powers are going against you. But there's no doubt that when we fight, we win. And I love that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are taking that slogan and running with it.
I'm thrilled with these two.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, before them, let's go with, you know, pre them, the Michelle Obama frame was what was the popular leftward frame. When they go, what is it? What's that comment again?
When they go low, we go high?
Yeah, that stupid thing. I love the fact that Tim Walz, I believe, is a guy who's going to say, when they go low, kid,
we kick them.
We bash their face into the ground. Oh, because that's what a football coach would tell you. That's what a football coach would tell you. When they go for your knees, right into the dirt.
Mm.
So they don't do it again.
Mm.
And I'm glad to see that someone's willing to, you know, ball up their little digits and get in there and mix it up.
Well, Tim Walz isn't holding back, and I think the people are really energized as a result. I mean, the guy is hilarious, and he knows how to work a room, and I think people feel the electricity whenever they hear him speak. I like the idea that Michelle Obama brings of staying with a more dignified approach on things, but, you know, maybe there's a balance there.
There's no balance there. Yeah, you know, when a bully pokes you in the chest, there's only one way you deal with a bully.
Mm.
You can't talk your way out of a bully. You can't go, oh, I understand your feelings.
Yeah.
Now, that never works. You got to take them on. And this is that scenario, because these are not people who are going to listen to reason. You've got to get out there and fight for your values.
Mm.
And I'm glad that they're moving us in that direction. I heard someone came by and said, you know, alpha liberal, something you've never heard before. I would consider myself that well before the term, because I'm going to stand up and fight for what's right. I want clean air. I want clean water, because I grew up in a place where we didn't have it.
Mm.
So I want good jobs for working people, opportunities for everyone, education, all the stuff that we hear come out of their campaign.
Wow. Alpha liberal. I feel like I'm going to incorporate that into my politics somehow. I feel like this it's interesting that you brought that up, because I think a lot of what's been happening in politics recently has to do with masculinity and the different types of visions of masculinity that different administrations want to portray. You've got the sort of bully in Donald Trump and J.D. Vance.
Yeah.
And then you've got Tim Walz, which is like a caring and fighting for people sort of approach. And I think that's resonating with people. People are really excited, and they feel that sort of both strength and warmth that Tim Walz is able to bring.
Look, I'm all for attempting to reason, but at the end of the road, you take on a bully ultimately one way, in the only language they understand.
Mm.
And I don't advocate for that, the first club out of the bag, but eventually that's where they're going to push you. And I feel that's where the MAGA, where the red hats have already pushed us.
Well, let's hope we can just deal with this at the ballot box.
No. Look, I'm not advocating for going out in the streets and getting into
course.
A fist fight. I'm talking about standing up for yourself.
Of course, yeah.
You know, I'm not advocating violence. although I'm someone who says, you poke me in the chest, we might have problems.
Right.
But, you know, the reality is, I think Democrats are finding that muscularity.
Mm.
They're finding that voice to say, no, I'm going to stand here. I'm going to stand my ground and fight.
That's right.
And when you do that, I think you then have the ability to have an honest discussion and make your points and change some hearts and minds. And I think they've done some of that by getting away from some of the harsher rhetoric, but also being able to deliver the punchline. As much as I love Joe Biden, as much as I love his record, just couldn't deliver the punchline.
Yeah, we're not cowering back, and we're not going back. And I think I love that tagline. We're not going back. And we're not going back to the bullies and the folks that are selling out our interests to the highest bidder. We're fighting back. We're standing our ground. We're making sure that we have the right policy in place, have the right ideas and values in place, and fighting, not going back. And there's this energy right now where people just want to get out. They want to vote. They want to volunteer. They want to share things on social media. There's an excitement that I haven't seen in a long time, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
Especially with young people. I mean, you're a young guy serving in the state house in Colorado. There are a lot of young people here. That energy is you can feel it. And hopefully they take that out into the streets, convince their friends, neighbors, their parents, their grandparents, the uncle that comes to Thanksgiving and destroys the event. maybe we have this coming together of this moment with the energy. I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I think we might see record-breaking results from young people. I think, you know, every time I hear Kamala Harris speak, she's talking about something that resonates with young people, whether it's climate, environmental justice. She's talking about housing affordability all the time, about building more housing so that I can finally afford to buy a house or at least rent a house at an affordable rate. These are the things that people care about, and young people in particular care about, and I think we're going to get out, we're going to volunteer, we're going to vote.
The reality is that she's read history.
That's right.
She's basically the same thing with Joe Biden. They were they revived the spirit of FDR and Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm.
Because you go back and you think about what it took to build the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity.
Mm.
That 1950s, 60s era where one income could support a family and do it well, where people were able to work hard, play by the rules, and get ahead. And you had an activist government that did build housing for people, that did ensure that there were opportunities. Not enough for everyone across the board, and I'm fully cognizant of that, but we have the opportunity to learn from that period and move forward and do those things in a different way and in an updated way.
Yeah. I think the vision that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are putting forward is about Democrats being about building things. Whether it's a great healthcare system or great infrastructure or great housing supply, we want to be on the front line of building things, enabling things to get done. And I think that's what government needs to do, is get things done. And I think that's what Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are going to do for us.
Well, I've been calling them get-her-done Democrats. It's good for my rural friends.
Get-her-done. That's right.
But Manny, last question I've got for you, and it's the most important one. Broncos fan?
Absolutely.
All right, good. Yeah, no. Going to have a good season this year?
We're going to go undefeated, and we're going to win the championship.
Well, you're going to go far.
Thanks, Rick. Manny, really appreciate you.
Manny Rutnell, State House Representative from Colorado. Want to hear your thoughts. You can chime in if you think the Broncos are going to go undefeated. I'm hopeful. I would love to see that in my lifetime. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I hope you've enjoyed today's program. Four great guests doing incredible work. I want to thank them, Caroline, Dawn, Adam, Manny, all incredible people. Thank you for the time at the DNC. Look, we really had a great time there. And we met so many really incredible people. It was fantastic. So I want to reiterate before we sign off that for the next at least 2 weeks, we're gonna be playing reruns. For the next 2 weeks, we're going to go back and we're going to replay the DNC convention and our coverage of that while I deal with this family issue, while I sit by my wife's side. And even if I'm just sitting there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's where I belong. That's where I need to be, and that's where I'm going to be with my family. I know you'll understand. I know you'll appreciate the position that we're in here at the program. So I look forward to seeing you very soon, and hopefully with some very good news. But for all of that, if you missed any of today's program, you can get the podcast. Go to TheRickSmithShow.com. Video, freespeech.org. And as I said, anytime. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Just in, Arizona Supreme Court rules nearly 98,000 people whose citizenship documents had not been confirmed can vote in state and local races. The court's decision comes after officials uncovered a database error that for two decades mistakenly designated the voters as having access to the full ballot. The first in-person votes of the 2024 presidential election have been cast in Virginia, South Dakota, and Minnesota. Meantime, in the battleground state of Georgia, there are new concerns about election night chaos. CBS's Scott McFarland.
Just as Vice President Kamala Harris arrived seeking new altitude in this battleground state, a Georgia state election board controlled by former President Donald Trump supporters is causing turbulence. With just more than 6 weeks until Election Day, three Republicans who hold a majority on the board voted to change the rules for handling ballots, requiring poll workers at each precinct in Georgia's 159 counties to conduct a hand count of all the ballots on election night, in addition to the traditional machine count.
Vice President Harris has held a rally in Madison, Wisconsin.
We will move forward. And just like Wisconsin state motto tells us, forward is where we go.
Former President Trump heads to North Carolina for a rally in Wilmington tomorrow. A new report from the Secret Service is critical of its own